The bass shakes the floorboards of a small studio in Kingston. It is 1982. Outside, the sun is a hammer. Inside, the air is thick with the smell of electronics and sweat. A producer moves a fader. A singer leans into a cheap microphone. They are creating a sound that will eventually travel across the Atlantic and the Pacific. It will fill stadiums in London and clubs in Tokyo. This melody will generate millions of dollars in licensing fees and publishing royalties. But right now, the man behind the microphone is thinking about his bus fare. He is thinking about his next meal. He does not know that his voice is about to be harvested like sugarcane. He does not see the lawyers, or the contracts, or the digital fingerprints that will one day track every vibration of his vocal cords. This is the history of the Caribbean music industry. It is a story of genius met with greed. It is our history of piracy and royalties and legal theft. The 1980s brought a digital revolution to the islands. Before this period, music was physical. It was a live band or a heavy vinyl record. Then came the rhythm boxes and the synthesizers. One drum machine could do the work of an entire band. This changed the economy of the studio. It made music faster and cheaper to produce. Producers began to build rhythms that they called riddims. In the Caribbean, a single riddim could be used by 50 different singers. This was the foundation of dancehall culture. It was a communal way of making art. Nobody was thinking about intellectual property in 1985. They were thinking about the sound system clash on Saturday night. If a rhythm worked, the people danced. That was the only validation that mattered. This communal approach created a massive library of sounds. These sounds were not protected by international copyright laws. Most artists did not have managers. They did not have lawyers. They had a handshake and a few dollars for a recording session. They signed away their rights on napkins or in verbal agreements that meant nothing in a court of law. While the music stayed within the islands, this system functioned. The money stayed in the community. But the world was listening. Radio stations in the United States and Europe began to pick up these frequencies. They heard the raw energy of the Caribbean, and they saw a product that was unprotected. International labels began to arrive in the late 1980s. They did not come to build studios or schools. They came to mine the talent. They brought contracts written in dense legal English. These documents were designed to be confusing. An artist would see $1,000 in cash and think they were rich. They did not realize they were giving up the rights to their music for the next 70 years. They did not understand that the label would recoup every cent of that $1,000 from their future earnings. The labels were not just buying songs. They were buying the DNA of a culture. They were taking the drums and the bass and the slang and turning them into a global commodity. By the 1990s, the theft became more sophisticated. This was the era of the sample. A producer in New York could take a 3-second clip of a reggae song and loop it. That loop would become the foundation of a pop hit. The pop star would get the credit. The pop star would get the award. The original Caribbean creator often got nothing. Sometimes they were not even mentioned in the credits. If they tried to sue, they were met with a wall of corporate lawyers. The cost of a legal battle was higher than the value of the soul. The system was rigged against the source. We see the results of this era today, in the hills of Jamaica and the streets of Port of Spain. There are legends of our music who live in poverty. These are people whose voices are known by millions of people across the planet. Their songs are played in commercials for luxury cars and expensive perfumes, yet they struggle to pay their electricity bills. This is not because they were lazy. It is because they were robbed by a system that values the paper over the performance. The industry calls it business. We call it a continuation of the old colonial extraction. They stopped taking the gold and the sugar, and they started taking the vibrations. The mid-1990s saw the arrival of the major label Scout. These men stayed in expensive hotels and visited the ghettos of the Caribbean. They looked for the hungriest artists. Hunger makes a man easy to manipulate. They offered dreams of private jets and mansions. They used the lack of formal education in our communities as a weapon. Many of our greatest songwriters cannot read music. Some could not read the fine print of a 100-page contract. They were told to trust the process. They were told that the label was a family, but a family does not charge you interest on your own talent. The midpoint turn happened when the digital age arrived. Suddenly, the music was not on a record or a tape. It was a file. It was invisible. This made the theft even easier. A song could be copied a million times in a second. The labels told the artists that piracy was the enemy. They said the people downloading music for free were the thieves. But the labels were still taking their cut from the shrinking pie. They created new types of contracts, called 360 deals. These deals gave the label a piece of everything. They took money from the live shows, they took money from the merchandise, they even took money from the artist's personal appearances. There is a specific case of a legendary singer from the 70pm era. He wrote a song that became an anthem for freedom. Decades later, a massive European brand used that song in a global campaign. The singer did not receive a single cent. The rights were owned by a shell company in a tax haven. The shell company was owned by a billionaire who had never set foot in the Caribbean. When the singer died, his family could not afford a proper burial. This is the reality of legal theft. The laws are written to protect the person who owns the song, not the person who birthed it. The transition to the 2000s did not fix the problem. It only changed the platform. Streaming services arrived with the promise of transparency. They claimed every play would be tracked, but the payout for a single stream is a fraction of a cent. To buy a loaf of bread, an artist needs thousands of streams. To pay rent, they need millions. Most of that money still goes to the distributors and the labels first. The Caribbean artist is at the bottom of the food chain. They provide the raw material, but they do not own the factory. We must talk about the cultural impact of this theft. When a community is robbed of its creative wealth, it loses its ability to sustain itself. Our music is our bank. It is our record of our struggles and our victories. When that wealth is exported, it leaves us empty. It forces our artists to leave the islands to find work. It creates a brain drain of our most creative minds. They go to New York or London or Toronto because that is where the money is kept. The islands are left with the memories, while the profits sit in foreign bank accounts. Now we are in the era of the 2026 landscape. The battle has moved to social media. Short videos use Caribbean music as a backdrop for trends. Millions of people use these sounds without knowing the artist. The algorithms decide who gets paid and who remains a ghost. There are new efforts to fight back. Legal collectives are forming in the islands. They are teaching young artists about publishing and masters. They are showing them how to read a contract before they pick up a pen. This is a new kind of resistance. It is not fought with fire, but with fine print. The legacy of this theft is written in the silence of the old studios. Many of the places where our greatest hits were recorded are now ruins. They are falling apart because the money never came back to maintain them. The equipment was sold off to pay debts. The tapes were left to rot in the humidity. This is a loss of our physical history. If we do not protect the rights, we cannot protect the records. If we do not own the music, we do not own our story. The final weight of this history lands on the shoulders of the next generation. They are smarter now. They see the traps that were set for their fathers and grandfathers. They are using technology to bypass the gatekeepers. They are releasing their music directly to the world. But the shadow of the old system is long. The big companies still hold the catalogs of the past. They still control the airwaves and the major playlists. The theft is not over. It has just become more efficient. We look at our history and we see a pattern. It is the pattern of the harvest. Someone else plants the seed. Someone else waters the ground. But the person with the biggest scythe takes the crop. In the 1980s, it was the record man. In the 90pm era, it was the lawyer. Today, it is the software developer. The names change, but the result is the same. The Caribbean provides the rhythm for the world, and the world forgets to pay for the soul. Our music is a living thing. It cannot be truly owned by a corporation. They can buy the rights, but they cannot buy the spirit. They can own the file, but they cannot own the feeling. The theft is real, and the poverty it causes is a crime. But the vibrations continue. They come from the zinc roofs and the street corners. They come from a place that a lawyer cannot reach. We must reclaim the business of our art so that the wealth of our culture stays where it was born.